Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Nazarita Goldhammer and Kevin Boilo. Here we are, Epis Radio, the last show of February 2023. That's 2023. Here we are. And we're still talking about this message that we keep driving at. We've been driving at it, believe it or not, for 9 years. And so we're framing it now as a disintimacy with nature. I finally understand Descartes more than I ever have. I started reading Descartes in high school. I was 16. And I knew there was something really funky about this mind-body split and this powerful philosophy that ended up ruling Western science and Western conceptions of the human. And I have worked for decades, and I finally understand that we created this way of understanding ourselves that radically separated us from ourselves, from my own nature. And in fact, there was it's kind of a cliche in psychoanalysis, something Freud called wild therapy or wild psychoanalysis, and the idea at the time was partially just that idea in itself, but partially the idea that only medical doctors could become psychoanalysts. Only they would have the ability to understand in the right way. And so wild psychoanalysis, which was obviously pejoratized by Freud, was every bit of Jung, who I've taught for many, many years. And Jung was a perfect example of the wild psychoanalyst. To move outside of the boundaries of scientific positivism, to move outside of the boundaries of Cartesianism, Cartesian dualism, dualistic ontology, and separating ourselves from our very feelings, from our bodies. And sure enough, everybody I know growing up, especially little boys, did this, where there's such existential fragmentation deep inside the average random human. Obviously, some of this is, there's been some reparative work done in ecofeminism, feminism in general, Humean studies in Scotland, about trying to repair this split. And you even see it in some of the healing practices where practitioners want to heal the mind and the body together. But to even talk like that, even say mind and body is dualistic. It's a dualistic framework within which you're trying to engage in a critique outside of the dualistic framework. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. Because we don't have the words. So, okay, so that's where we are. And I want to share personally that I have worked 25 hours a day to understand the split in myself. Because you can't do cultural critique or social critique unless you critique yourself. It's not possible. Because all of culture is inside me, and I am inside of culture. I am everything, and everything is me. And this is a different metaphysics than most people want to admit. So in other words, you can't engage in social transformation unless you transform yourself. It's absolutely true. Transforming yourself, though, is not enough. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition in logic. Necessary, but it's not sufficient. We need a sufficient condition as well. And so here we are, Nazarita Goldhammer, and I've been having lots of discussions lately about how humans of all kinds continue to destroy our home, our earth. We're today, who knows how many acres of land we will have destroyed, how many waters we will have polluted, how many sentient beings we will have harmed, maimed, and murdered. How many little girls and little boys we will have hurt. How many women we will have hurt. How many disabled people, aged people we will have hurt. It's constant. And so when we talk about the intimacy with nature and we talk about the interrelational self, we are so far from a non-alienated interrelational self. And that's why we have textbooks called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, to try to deal with some of the reverberations of this alienation in our culture, because psychiatry was born from history. Psychiatry was born from the way we dealt with ourselves, others, and the planet. That's what it was about. So it's all contextualized. American psychiatry is not a universal science. It is a pseudoscience that is a response to a historical predicament. And problem with that kind of approach is that you end up falling off the horse on the other side. We have a whole new set of problems. The new problems are is that we've created more obfuscation and confusion about our situations, and it's more difficult than ever to think with clarity. And so, but just by way of philosophizing for a bit, you go all the way back to the Cartesian meditations on first philosophy. One of Descartes' tests was so-called clearness and distinctness, like you would know that 2 + 2 = 4. In other words, it was to adopt an analytically true model to understand reality. And so there's a bit of a deception in this, because I can know a lot of things that are analytically true. Definitions of words, mathematics, logics. But that doesn't mean those things adequately represent reality. And it's taken me this long to get it. These are creations of the mind, and they're creations of history. And so, you know, so many people revere physics and mathematics and logic. You know, some of the foundations of Western science. But that's all on one side only. That's on the objective side. So the physicist only studies the objective side of the correlation between the subject and the object, the knower and the known, the noema and the noematic. The physicist only deals with the one hemisphere. But what we need to discover is the situatedness of the human. And so we've already set up from the ground what operates as epistemology, what operates as truth and knowledge. Even before we begin these sciences, we've already created a sleight of hand. And this is why you have people who have citizens and human beings who are very, very upset. And they don't know why. It's because we're trying to force our experience, our natural, loving, interrelational experience, into these theoretical, abstract formulations. It doesn't work. It will never work. So, Nazarita, thanks for being here again, just like me, every week. We come at this thing. We're continuing our long discussion about the interrelational self and intimacy with nature. Where do we stand on this now? What sorts of thoughts have come to mind today for you?
So I watched this video this morning, and it was a really sweet video concerning like mind-body connection, not only with ourselves but with others. And it was a woman, and she was fostering a week-old puppy that hadn't eaten. And they told her the puppy was expected to die. She shouldn't get her hopes up. And if the puppy didn't eat, then she should prepare that he would die. And so she was scared to death. So she tried to feed him for 2 days, and he wouldn't take anything. She kept replaying all these things in her mind about how he's going to die. If he didn't eat, what was she going to do? And he probably wouldn't make it. And so she decided to do a change. And in her path, she meditated, cleared all thoughts of fear from her mind. And as soon as she did that, which was kind of miraculous, the puppy started to eat. And I was really struck by this because I don't know if you know, but there's placebo pills out there. I mean, there's placebo pills for Adderall and birth control, and that. So what they're finding is that placebos are the connection of the mind body. It's like what we, you know, that old saying, what you think you are. And so here it is. And so many people, and this relates to climate change, it relates to our way of life, overconsumption. If we think we have to have something, we will have to have it. If we think we are sick, we will be sick. Now this isn't, you know, saying that there aren't illnesses in the world and that affect us that we have to take care of through allopathic medicine. This is to say that there's a lot of connection between the way that we think, anger, fear, insecurity, that affects how we are. And it also affects our relationship with others, our relationship with the natural world, our relationship with building. And so this is a most important part of this. And they often say, when you're doing alternative, which is what they call it here in the United States, alternative medicine, which is the natural medicine that has been around for millions of years, which is herbs, you know, the right way of eating and thinking, that what that will do is it will actually cure certain illnesses. If you eat right, if you think right, if you de-stress, if you you know, you have to have a recognition of others in your life, you know, your relationships, the responsibility of what we do in our lives is really important. And I think you and I were reading something that came out. It was this morning, and the title of it was, what would happen if Edinburgh and Stockholm went vegan? And, you know, this was that 2018, someone published a report, Joseph Poor, and they called it his groundbreaking research. And what's so interesting is that we've known these facts for a long time, but this is groundbreaking because every time someone hears it, it's like they haven't heard anything before, and it's like they don't act on it. But anyway, part of the study was that meat and dairy provide 18% of calories despite using 83% of farmland and producing 60% of agriculture's greenhouse gas emissions. And so what they found, which is, you know, this is not new knowledge, a vegan diet is the biggest way to reduce your impact on planet Earth, and not just greenhouse gases, but global acidification, land use, water use. And it's far bigger than buying an electric car or cutting down on your airline flights. And yet it's the simplest thing to do. And yet people are afraid to do it. It's just like our health, you know. we have control over our health, but oftentimes we prefer the pill to what we consider the easier way, which is to control our eating, our thoughts. Instead, we want a pill to mitigate those things. And this just is exactly what you're talking about. It's like we have this duality in our minds that separates what happens in our body from what happens in our mind and emotions. It's like we believe they're all separate, and yet they're all connected. And we're connected to the environment, we're connected to others, and somehow in our evolution, we have sedimented the thought that we are separate, that we are somehow in control of things that we are not in control of, and that we're not responsible for those things that we should be responsible for.
So some people, Nazarita, talk about the death instinct. You know, lots of psychiatrists, psychologists, psychoanalysts, philosophers, literary figures. You know, we don't even have to, it's not even the label that's important, but it's, think about Eros, or the erotic life-giving force that we all know, we all feel it, we understand it. And then think about Thanatos. Think about biological drive. All beings have materiality, and they die. They live and they die. There's a life cycle. And so there is a death drive, as you might call it, but whatever you want to call it, there's a life cycle that ends in death. And so a lot of people have taken that concept and articulated really beautiful, flowing, brilliant ways about the confusion, perhaps, that some people have about the difference between the life instinct and the death instinct, or conatus, in the Latin, the drive for life, thanatos in the Greek, death. And we have so many knowledgeable people now, and some apparently very intelligent people who continue to engage in life decisions that are participating in this death drive, participating in a quest for death. Because what we are doing right now is, more than not, we're killing the planet. We're killing the biosphere. For anybody to say that we're not doing that, they literally would have to be living in a vacuum somewhere in a cave, or not have not read any books, or have not studied any NASA data, or data from thousands of climate scientists. There's enough of us now where we know that something is amiss, something is afoot. Like, we really know. This is one of my basic assumptions in my thinking, is that many of us know these things, and yet the decisions that an individual makes in his life are counter to what we know. I mean, how could this be? How could this be? This is the question I'm trying to understand. How could this be? Many people continue to throw compost material in garbage. We continue, all of us, and me included, we should be really aware of everything we do when we order goods and services. I think we should ask the tougher questions. What does this mean? What am I not seeing here? What is the supply chain? You know, is there any exploitation? Is there any pollution or harm caused in what I'm seeking, in what I'm ordering? And it takes a lot of work. So there's no damnation here. There's no critique. It's more an admonition and an encouragement that we all have work to do. On the other hand, there do seem to be some individuals who know better and who literally don't care. So I'll just list some things. We have police officers who continue to murder black men. They're violent, they're aggressive, and they seem to get, there don't seem to be legal recriminations for their behavior as much as there should be. We have massive mining companies mining all over the world. We have petroleum companies sucking fossil fuels out of the ground in pristine environments that we're never going to be able to repair. It could be, they're talking on the order of 50 to 500,000 years to repair some of this damage, or even more. I mean, that's so far into the future, all of us are going to be way gone. In fact, if there are any beings alive in 50,000 years, there won't be much of a record of us, and certainly not in 500,000 years. So you know, what is it that keeps guiding us? I see people who are aggressive, who are selfish, who are mean, who are cruel, who actually really enjoy, I call it franchising violence. Today I call it franchising violence. What that means is that there are enough people who figured out that we do live in a violent civilization, and I think they've caricaturized it or fetishized it. If that makes any sense. They've turned it into a fetish, and it's kind of like when people use humor to avoid anxiety. People, a lot of times, will use humor, laughing to avoid an uncomfortable truth, an awkwardness, shame. And so laughter is never just laughter. That's silly. That's childhood thinking. Laughter covers up a lot. And sadism is a form of laughter at violence. Very, very sad indeed. Very, very sad that we can do that. So is this a solutions-oriented weekly internet radio show, Nazarita? Is that what this is? What I think it is to continue to dig deeper, and we can do that through dialogue. This is another one of my assumptions, is that no matter who you are, no matter how aware you think you are, we can always do better to have conversations. If people don't challenge you in your life, you should go find a group who challenges you. This is what I say to people. You can't go around the world being 100% confident anymore. There's so much that's amiss. So how do we construct, Nazarita, this? I guess this is a specific question. How do we construct a way to think about our interrelational self? Supports the good, promotes the good. How do we do that?
What's funny is that I really have always subscribed to the idea, which has been taught really in a lot of Eastern teachings, about reincarnation. And really, in the end, reincarnation is really about responsibility. It isn't so much about you have an endless time to change who you are. It's about accepting responsibility for your actions, because there will be repercussions from what we do. And that responsibility means that we think differently about our lives. So in terms of, let's just call it the continuity of being. And if we have that, then we wouldn't be so fast to kill somebody with a gun, or And we wouldn't also be so fast to, at the expense of everything, including the environment, other animals, other species of our own, to get ahead and to trample on and to subordinate others. We wouldn't have that because we would start to accept responsibility for our actions, knowing that we would have to answer for them. You know, a good one is population. You know, they've done experiments where they've tried to control population. But controlling population doesn't have anything to do with actual making sure someone doesn't have more than two children. It isn't a dictate. What it is the underlying responsibility. A lot of people have children because they're lonely. They have children because they want to carry on their genetic material. But if you really look at the whole, we are all part of the genetic material of the earth. And so there would be less, if we had the right responsibility, we would have more community. There would be less push to overpopulate the earth. And if we did that, it all boils down to what you and I have talked about so many times is responsibility. In the West, what we believe is whoever comes out ahead wins. That's that old competition. If I have more money than you, I win. If I live in a better house, I win. If I have more friends, I win. If I have more children, I win. But if you really think of the continuity of life and the responsibility that we should all be looking at, and that's the deeper conversation. The deeper conversation is what is our responsibility to ourselves, to others, to the earth? In a lot of, you know, Christian religions, you know, it's really easy for them to just go and ask forgiveness and then go and commit the same sin again and again and again, knowing that they just have to have a slight repetition to be absolved from their sins, which is a lack of responsibility. I don't know how that ever came about, that someone could give you words to say 10 times in, or 100 times or 10 times, and then you would be absolved from your sin and you could still go back and do the same thing again, just keep coming back. It just seems so ludicrous that we have this system in some of the Christian cultures. So the ideal is the recognition of really the continuity of life. It is. They used to say in some of the Eastern religions, don't swat that fly. It could be your aunt or your uncle. Transmigration of souls, which means that we share, if you want to put it into really Western terms, we share responsibility for all life. Because we don't know that life, we still have the sacred responsibility to respect it, to be open to it, and to actually learn from it. And that's where we're closed off. That responsibility to our bodies, we, our lack of responsibility for our emotions, our thinking, death, the death instinct. I think that it's more, we have so much death in the United States, it's so much more prevalent of people taking other people's lives. And I think it's because we don't really have that idea of the continuity of life, of what you do now, you will be responsible for. You don't get out of it. You know, just because you're living a good life and you don't, that responsibility is abdicated. You know, when you're 70, you can die and 90 and die. And it doesn't matter at that point because it does. And that's part of the thing, part of the concept that I think we're missing in responsibility is that it is, responsibility is a really deep, deep connection with everything, and that responsibility means looking after the other. I mean, every morning I get up, I put birdseed out. Every morning I look at it because my responsibility, once I put it out, is that now I'm responsible, and I have to accept that responsibility to say, I have done this, and now I need to be responsible for it, just like we talk about composting. You know, we could have rich soil. Soil's a big, big thing in everywhere, don't you think? Where they're saying we have to enrich the soil, and yet composting will do that, and yet hardly anybody composts. And so we keep having this nihilistic view of our life on Earth, that it doesn't continue, that we don't have responsibility for our actions, we don't have responsibility for our thoughts, our feelings, the way that we act, or the way that we treat others, and the way that we harm the Earth. That for some reason we think that money will buy us out of all of those things, like a Catholic novena where you can pray for 50 times and be absolved from your crime. That's what we think. The more money we have, the more absolution we think that we can do. We can absolve ourselves from all responsibility with that. Money's become the new prayer. Money's become the new way of absolving what we think is our responsibility. What do you think of that? I think I may have lost you a little bit there.
I'm here. I'm back.
Good. Okay.
So, great.
Okay.
So.
What,
I like to
what
always
I was saying.
Go. I heard you, and I can actually give you a really good response. So thank you. So I like to go all the way down into the deepest recesses of the pond, and what gives rise to the pond, and how what comes underneath the pond and into the pond percolates its way up to the top of the pond, which is what we see. That's the visible world. But underneath the visible world is the invisible world. Those are obviously what Professor Bohm called the implicate order, what philosophers often call ontology or worlding, what physicists call worlds or universes, or even multiverses. And so we have this way of thinking, Nazarita, that is not at the foundation. It's one step up. What's at the bottom is a certain way of constructing what I call an adumbration. It's a new word for a lot of people, an adumbration. It's a precognitive intuition where we have a sense of reality. We have a sense that we are a consciousness. And by the way, each person does have a consciousness. I am not the other. The other is not me. It's not a super consciousness. And there are religions that wrongly, in my view, posit that that's true. It's just not true. My pre-reflective awareness, my adumbration is mine. Yours is yours. Mine is mine. However, I'm affected deeply by all the others. That's that interrelational self at work. I'm terribly affected by others. And so I'm born into this physical body. A bunch of other people set the rules. They create languages. But they have determined, before I was even around, how we're going to structure being, or how we're going to structure our adumbration or apprehension, the precognitive awareness of an experience of being. Well, then we layer on top of that thinking. And so there's always a movement in the human between an adumbration or precognitive awareness, an intuition, subjective intuition, and thinking, which is a reflexive or reflection, an X, to reflective capacity or faculty in the human. We think about things. But the problem in thinking is that we think about things in terms of the structure that we've already set, and it becomes sedimented. And that's why critical thinking is actually quite a very difficult enterprise. It's really easy to slosh around words. I know lots of people who have golden tongues, who can talk well, but that doesn't mean they're saying anything of importance. So we have this way of thinking where we've interpreted our very being. Maybe it's through terror, fear, these primary adumbrations that lead to what we now call emotions or affect. And through this bodily awareness, because I am a body, I live my body. This is the great existential theme. I live my body. You might say, well, I'm not my body. I would correct it to say I live my body. I don't live in my body. I live my body because I am a body. Obviously a topic, a very important topic. You know, nothing that's not important. It's very important. But the fact of the matter is we have this way of interpreting our bodily existence as a material being on the planet, carbon-based unit who has adumbrations, intuitions, affect, and then thinking. That's reflection. But what we get from all the great artists, the poets, the brilliant musicians, the thinkers, the visionaries, storytellers, painters, we get these open visions about being. And that's why most people love great art. You go to Paris, you go to the best museums in the universe. These are people who had visions of how things could be. They open up our eyes to the multiverse, to multiple ontologies, different ways of creating worlds, new worlds, not the same, different. And so, unfortunately, in the world right now, both at West and East, unfortunately, the East has been infected just as much as the West by these ways of thinking. And thinking has become purposeful, instrumentalized, cause and effect, explanatory. And that in itself, that way of thinking, becomes determinative of how we set up everything, including economic structures, including commodification. Everybody is now reified into a thing. Everything you do can be commodified into a value on the open market and the stock exchange in New York. It's crazy. I mean, we're commodifying private prisons. Just think about that. That's just outrageous. But it comes from a way of thinking. It's not the other way around. We didn't just dream these things up concreto. We have created the structure. So it's a way of interpreting being. And right now, so all of these, Nazarita, all of the, I think the challenges we face with the younger people who are really quite upset at life, they're healthy. They're crying out is that they don't like the way things are. And we're not intimate with nature. You know, and I'll just say this one point, maybe we can riff on this for a little bit, but it's like people think of nature as something you go spectate. And people get their gear, they go buy their gear, Patagonia or REI, they make their trip, they make their little plan, they get their topo map, and then they go out and they hike on this trail that thousands of other people are hiking, and they throw their fucking garbage out all over the place. There's ample research that shows that our very presence in the wild affects animals who live there. That's their house. But we just feel like we can invade it. That's not intimacy with nature. It's just not intimacy with nature. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is intimacy with nature? This is the question. So how do we begin to answer that, Nazarita?
Well, here's a great quote on commodification, because this is part of the answer. Commodification is the enemy of meaning. And I think that that's really what we've been talking about is the meaning. What is meaning? What gives our lives meaning? And, you know, and how are we so unaware of what we embrace internally as giving our lives meaning in what we do on the physical plane as denying that responsibility for being. And just the fact that you brought up, like, we're invading the rest of the world. We're taking away land from others who have the right to live their animals, other species, and we're trying to annihilate them. And yet internally, we find them fierce, beautiful, joyous, all the adjectives that can describe someone who is in love with another species that sees and respects them. And yet outwardly, we're defying that. We're defying what we really believe. And that's what we've been talking about, is this separation from what we morally, internally believe from what our actions are doing. And how do we bring those together? Like, how do we bring them together? It doesn't seem to work to just confront people, because, you know, there's this, there has to be a way of teaching. There has to be a way of relearning what is prevalent in our culture so that we can take responsibility for being, for meaning, for love, for our actions, to decommodify the way that we live. And who's going to start it? Like, I thought this at the beginning of COVID. I thought the world will not change. And yet COVID, by an act of nature, changed a lot of the ways that we live. Whereas there wasn't any law, there wasn't any speech, there wasn't any book that actually did that. It came actually from nature. I believe that nature will have the last word. There will be climate migration, because nature will fight. Nature is responding to the hubris of humans who think that they control everything.
So there it is. It's controlling. It's a way of thinking, manipulating. I think, I hate to say this, Mazarita, but I think we're all under the spell of a giant narcissism. I really do. I see it in myself. I just detest it. And it's that, I think genius is and creativity is more about being open and available to letting the reality of the world in. The world is plenty complex and beautiful and wonderful. And each person, you know, we know people, each person is only capable of letting in so much of the world, which is sad. And you can see it, the way the metaphors they use, tone of voice, language, overall language ability, whatever. But it says everything. And then you have the creative genius and the best of our geniuses. Take Matisse, for example, or Van Gogh. They let in. And it's not that far from schizophrenia or psychosis. It's letting in what is, to pushing it out. And even Sartre was aware of this, that the great habit of humans was to, we're so terrified of reality, we just want to push it all out. And that pushing out is like controlling it. It's like instrumentalizing thinking, which is why science has become so fashionable. So we're out of time. Thank you for a wonderful discussion. I think we're making some strides in our understanding, developing it. These things need to be talked about 100 different ways. And we'll be back to all of our listeners. We love you very much. And we look forward to being back with you next Monday. This is Epis Radio, Nazarita Goldhammer and Kevin Boylow signing out. Have a good week.